There are a lot of victories that have been secured. Some of them are partial. Some of them in ways that the other side doesn't yet know are foundations for what's coming. And that's just the beginning.
That's Kevin Roberts, head of the Heritage Foundation and their Project 2025.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
You may have heard some news about it.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Don't believe the news.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
At least not about them winding
and
it down.
I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX. Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day for your listening convenience on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. We will get to Kevin Roberts, the head of the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025, who you heard at the top of the show. We will get to him a little bit later this hour, I think. But you're likely to see the headlines that they're shutting down Project 2025. Don't believe it. Don't buy it. Not for a second. They've been working on it for decades. It ain't going anywhere just because it's annoying Donald Trump lately to be called out on it.
Yeah, don't be fooled.
Anyway, more on that later. Arizonans on Tuesday headed to the polls for statewide congressional primaries there. Happily, I've yet to see any problem reports for voters in the state at the polls, though election denier and 2022 gubernatorial loser Republican Carrie Lake was on the ballot again on Tuesday. She's running for the GOP nomination for the U.S. Senate to run against Democrat Ruben Gallego for the Senate seat being mercifully vacated this year by Kyrsten Sinema. So unless Lake wins the nomination on Tuesday, we might expect to hear about problems, real or pretend, at the polling place over the next few days that Kerry Lake will be complaining about, whether they exist or not. We will, of course, have both any noteworthy results and any reported problems for voters or via tabulation on our next Bradcast. Remember, Tennessee votes in their primaries on Thursday this week, and there are primaries in Michigan, Kansas, Missouri, and Washington State next Tuesday. Early voting is already underway, so get out and vote. If you live in any of those states, good practice for November.
Exactly. Make sure you're still registered no matter where you are, because, you know, that happens a lot where people unexpectedly get purged.
Much more election-related news ahead today, but we do need to begin here for today for the moment. It was just last week, I think, that we reported on multiple landslides in Ethiopia, in eastern Africa, that killed, at the time that we reported on it, at least 230 people, many of them pregnant women and children, though the UN says the final death toll there is likely to be closer to 500. That after rescuers were actually pulling victims from one landslide in Ethiopia when they themselves were buried by a second one amid heavy climate change fueled rains. And now today, A week or so later, about 2,500 miles across the Arabian Sea in southwestern India, an all too similar and tragic story is playing out today. Another chapter in our so-called climate-changed future, which is actually happening right now, as it turns out, Desi Doyen.
Yes, unfortunately it is. So AP reports that multiple landslides in southern India have killed at least 93 people as we go to air. Many others are still feared trapped under the debris, according to officials. And that's because of torrential rains that triggered huge landslides, torrents of mud and water that swept across tea estates, tea plantations, and villages. The landslides hit hilly areas in Kerala State's Wayanad district early on Tuesday, and it flattened homes, uprooted trees, destroyed bridges and roads. Rescuers are working now to pull out people that are stuck under the debris and the mud, but their efforts are being hampered by blocked roads and unstable terrain. So authorities really have yet to determine the full scope of the disaster. Kerala's chief minister said that more than 3,000 people have now been moved to relief camps, but he did not specify how many people they believe are missing or trapped under the debris. Local media reports that most of the victims are workers on tea estates. The Indian Army is assisting to help build a temporary bridge. The state health minister says, quote, "We are trying in every way to rescue our people." There is good reason to believe that climate change is part of this, because India's weather department has put Kerala on alert because the state has been lashed by incessant rains, according to AP. Downpours have disrupted life for many, and authorities have closed schools in some parts of the region, and more rains are predicted. Now, Kerala is prone to heavy rains, flooding, and landslides, but scientists say that monsoons in the region are becoming more erratic because of global warming.
Oh, who could have guessed?
Yeah, Roxy Matthew Cole, a climate scientist at the Indian Institute of Tropical Meteorology, said, quote, "Monsoon patterns are increasingly erratic, and the quantum of rainfall that we receive in a short spell of time has increased." He also cited the authorities that say rapid construction activities that are happening in these areas that are prone to landslides are also contributing, because, you know, construction helps to destabilize the terrain, and especially mountainous areas, and that increases the risk of landslides.
Yeah, especially when they got, as they did here, some 11 inches of rain in just 24 hours.
Yeah, that's not normal.
No, well, maybe it is now.
Well, yeah. A 2013 report by a federal government-appointed committee said that 37% of the total area of the Western Ghats Mountains should be declared an eco-sensitive area, and there should be restrictions on any form of construction. But the report's recommendations have not been implemented so far because state governments and residents have opposed it.
A 2013 report, 10 years ago, 11 years ago, they warned about this, and they are still doing it anyway. The construction is still continuing, and now they are paying the price. So I do wonder if that will continue after a day like today, or how many others will have to die before they do, whether it's in India or Ethiopia or damn near everywhere else around the world at this point, thanks to our quickly worsening man-made global climate crisis.
Right.
More along those lines, like it or not, including right back here in Texas and in California later this hour in Desi Doyen's latest Green News Report. But allow me to sort of take a screeching turn here to report some considerably brighter news from back here at home today. News that caught our eye at the White House website, but received shockingly very little attention from corporate media on Monday. So it seems worth highlighting here, at least quickly today, as the Biden statement at the whitehouse.gov reads, "As of Monday, over 600,000 Teamster workers and retirees have pensions now protected from devastating cuts. They earned those pensions after working for decades, and now they can retire with dignity," the statement says. "This didn't happen by accident," the Biden statement continues. "It's because my administration is keeping our commitment to America's workers. Today's action protects the pensions of 70,000 workers and retirees in New England, including 6,000 in New Hampshire, where my team is making this announcement alongside Senators Jeanne Shaheen and Maggie Hassan, both Democrats, by the way, and the New England Teamsters Pension Fund. To date, he notes, we have protected more than 40,000 Teamsters in Ohio and Michigan, more than 30,000 in Illinois and Missouri, and more than 20,000 in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Pennsylvania. Because of the American Rescue Plan and the support of congressional Democrats who passed it without a single Republican vote, the White House statement accurately notes, over 1 million union workers and retirees have already been protected from brutal cuts of up to 75% to the pensions they sacrificed so much to secure. So remind me again why Republicans have been able to hoax voters in the Rust Belt and elsewhere into believing that they are the party of the forgotten working man? So what happened here? Because there was very little news about this. We just happened to see the statement at the White House. What actually occurred on the ground for these workers? It was not easy actually to find much news on this, but Boston Globe reported on Monday. Scott Gove, a 57-year-old driver for United Parcel Service, is breathing easier now that he knows the pension he has been counting on for retirement will be paid out in full after all. Gove, who has worked 36 years for UPS and still has at least a couple more years to go before he retires, said he and fellow members of the New England Teamsters Local 633 Union had grown accustomed to disconcerting updates about the looming insolvency of their pension fund. But the anxiety over potentially having their retirement benefits slashed has, for now, dissipated now that the federal government, yes, the same federal government that Republicans in their Project 2025 are vowing to slash from top to bottom, the federal government, that one, has stepped in to rescue New England Teamsters Local 633 and their multi-employer pension plan, as well as others like it. Quote, this is a giant relief for me personally and my family, knowing that my pension is secured until I am well into the ground, Gove told the Globe on Monday at an event announcing the approval of assistance for the New England Teamsters Pension Fund. This announcement means that roughly 72,000 workers and retirees across New England will no longer face potential cuts to their pension benefits. This group, which includes freight and delivery drivers, warehouse and bakery workers, and others, covers about 28,400 people in Massachusetts, 13,300 in Connecticut, 6,100 in perennially closely divided New Hampshire, 4,700 in Rhode Island, 3,600 in Maine, 1,300 in Vermont. That, according to the White House, which celebrated the development as an accomplishment by President Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris, and the Democrats in Congress. Nationwide, according to the Boston Globe, more than 1.1 million workers and retirees, including many who already had their benefits cut, have now been helped by this program. It was established as part of the American Rescue Plan, a stimulus package that Congress passed in 2021. Happily, the Globe's very next sentence after saying Congress passed it in 21 is to note that, quote, Republicans all voted against the bill. Good. Thank you, Boston Globe.
Yes.
Allies of the Biden-Harris administration are touting this legislation, noting its benefits for members of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, even as Union President Sean O'Brien has been flirting with possibly endorsing the GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump after backing Biden 4 years ago. You may recall O'Brien, as we played a clip and discussed it on this show a week or so ago, spoke at the recent Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, for some reason, in which he seemed to be slamming greedy corporate elites that he accused of being incompatible with the needs of working class Americans and union members. So why he was speaking at a Republican convention is beyond me. While critics have said that this legislation, amounts to a bailout. The White House American Rescue Plan coordinator, Gene Sperling, said that the public should recognize that workers are the ones who are benefiting here. All of this, he said, is going to the hardest working people in America, often the ones who have had the most physically taxing jobs over the decades. The legislation set up a special financial assistance program to allow struggling multi-employer pension plans to apply for assistance from a federal agency that protects the retirement incomes of workers in these defined benefit pension plans. Have I mentioned that every Republican in both the House and Senate voted against this bill? And no, by the way, noting that is not partisan. You know, in case some in the corporate media can't tell the difference between partisanship and demonstrable facts that help inform and educate the electorate about their government in the advance of an election, when the White House, one-third of the U.S. Senate, and the entirety of the GOP-controlled U.S. House of Representatives will be on the ballot. Seems to me that voters should know this and to know the facts about it. The arrangement, says the Globe, is designed to stall the insolvency of roughly 200 multi-employer pension plans for 30 years. Many of these plans faced funding shortfalls during and after the Great Recession. Huh, who caused that one? That was back when plans were left with many more retirees than they had active workers. Company bankruptcies and withdrawals from the plan, as well as investment losses in 2001 and again in 2008.
During Republican administrations.
With the stock market collapse, that greatly reduced the amount of money in plans, in these plans, according to the nonprofit Pension Rights Center. Senator Jeanne Shaheen, a Democrat from New Hampshire, said workers who forewent potentially better paying jobs so that they could instead bank on the long-term retirement security that a pension plan offers should not be held responsible for the corporate mergers and the market fluctuations and the other factors that contributed to challenges related to the way these funds performed. She told the Globe, quote, "I think we have a responsibility as elected officials to ensure that people are able to get benefits that they paid for and that they have been promised." Shaheen appeared alongside fellow Democratic Senator Maggie Hassan at the announcement on Monday. I guess no Republicans showed up for this event for some reason. She said the Biden administration recognizes the middle class, quote, built America, and that labor unions played a big role in that. She added, one of the important pieces of the American dream is not just being able to own your own home and get a good job and put your kids through school and have health care, but it's also about having a secure retirement.
What a concept.
Well, it's a concept that I think a lot of young people today don't even know. What's a pension? Never heard. How does a pension work?
Exactly.
And I'm not insulting young people. They don't know about it because pensions don't be happening anymore unless you're in a union.
That's correct.
At this point.
And remember, there is another aspect to this. Bankruptcy is a legal tool that companies can use to shove off their pension and health care responsibilities for retirees and current workers by just creating a new company that then they set up to go bankrupt. And that's how they get out of it.
And so, they get out of the pensions that these people have worked for decades for.
Exactly. So calling it a bailout is a way to lie about who's actually responsible for this and then try to blame the workers.
So thanks to the Biden-Harris administration and to Democrats, but not Republicans, in Congress, as the White House noted on Monday, over 1 million union workers and retirees have now already been protected through this plan from cuts of up to 75% to the pensions that these workers had worked their whole lives to secure. So why isn't that at the top of the news? Oh, because media are so busy, playing dumb clips from Donald Trump and J.D. Vance and their obnoxious rallies or something. I guess we got to do that, too. But all hands on deck, I guess, when democracy itself is on the line.
Yeah, I have a theory about this. I think it's because Biden isn't running anymore. So the corporate media has gone back to ignoring him and everything he does.
Well, they were ignoring him when he was running.
Until they decided he was old.
Unless he fell over a sandbag on the stage, then they would cover him.
Exactly.
But other than that, anyway, nonetheless, the encouraging news now for democracy advocates and autocracy opponents, well, that continues now as we head into the second week following Joe Biden's decision to drop out of the 2024 presidential race to hand the reins to his vice president, Kamala Harris, on this November's ballot. Now, as you know, when covering elections, we tend to mostly focus on not on the horse race, but on the track conditions on which those horses are running. I've got a number of related stories, track condition stories, that I hope to get to in a bit today. And as I suspect, we will be increasingly covering them over the next 3 months until Election Day. And then, bet your bottom dollar, we will be covering it beyond Election Day. Sorry. But as to the horse race, especially given how unusual this race now is, with the unprecedented nature of an incumbent president just dropping out 3 months before Election Day and a presidential candidate who has been convicted of 34 felonies, vowing to be a dictator on day one and running largely so that he can just stay out of prison. Well, all of that, we will be focusing on the horse race as well in the days ahead. And so to that end right now, Kamala Mentum appears to be continuing into its second week since Biden dropped out of the race and endorsed her for the top of the ticket. We are seeing more and more credible polls now coming out in recent days suggesting that the vice president is now surging into at least a tie race or just above the former president, both nationally and in a number of critical swing states. It's early still, of course, and these numbers just present a snapshot of what Americans may be feeling right now, according to the limited number of polls that we have about a head-to-head race between Harris and Trump at this point, and an even broader race when Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and other third-party candidates are factored in. In most cases, Harris actually performs better against Trump when poll respondents are asked to include those third-party candidates in their answers, for what it's worth. But an ABC ABC News Ipsos poll released on Sunday focused not on who Americans might prefer to vote for in November as much as the favorability and unfavorability for each of the candidates right now, and how those numbers compare to the numbers from the same poll just 1 week prior to Biden dropping out of the race. So we can compare the numbers just before he dropped out and just after he dropped out. And that initial week, by the way, came just after both the assassination attempt on Donald Trump and the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, where one would expect a bump for Trump and the Republicans in general. But according to the ABC Ipsos numbers here, in the new poll released on Sunday this week, Vice President Kamala Harris is enjoying a rather notable bounce in her favorability ratings amongst Americans. The vice president's favorability rating has jumped to 43%, with an unfavorable rating falling to 42%, according to ABC News and Ipsos. That puts her favorability above water, well, by one single point in this week's poll. But in the same poll released a week earlier, Harris's favorability rating was 35, while some 46% viewed her unfavorably. So her favorable unfavorables were 11 points underwater in the previous week and now 1 point above water this past week. That's a swing of 12 points in a very good direction for Kamala Harris.
That's a strong trend.
Her favorable number jumped 8 points and her unfavorable number dropped by 4 points between those two polls. At currently 1 point above water, Harris also outperformed Donald Trump and his negative 16-point favorable unfavorable rating, with just 36% of Americans seeing him as favorable versus Harris, who has 43% favorable, and Trump's 52% unfavorable rating compared to Harris's 42% unfavorable. All very good news, obviously, for Democrats and other opponents of the former president. But it wasn't only Democrats where Harris's outlook is seems to be improving here. 44% of independents now have a favorable view of Harris, which is way, way up from only 28% 1 week earlier. That's a 16-point favorability bump for Harris among independent voters over the polling over the past 2 weeks. Her unfavorability rating among independents is now down to 40% from 47 the week prior in the very same poll. That's a drop of 7.
Also a strong trend.
Harris also now enjoys an edge over Trump when it comes to how much enthusiasm Americans feel for the both of them as nominees. 48% of Americans say they would feel enthusiastic if Harris becomes the Democratic nominee, while just 39% say the same thing about Trump being the Republican nominee. Enthusiasm for Harris as the Democratic nominee peaks among Democrats at 88%. 49% of independents express enthusiasm for her, while just 31% of independents are enthusiastic about Donald Trump. Now, I know this is a lot of numbers, but I think you get the gist. They all seem to be moving in the same direction, towards the Democratic candidate, Bigley, and away from the Republican candidate in just 1 week's time. In a, you know, pretty apples-to-apples comparison of results from the same poll from 1 week to the next, where in that poll, Trump's favorability rating, the second poll, the most recent one, has dropped over the past week. It was from 40% measured in the week of the attempted assassination and the Republican convention to just 36 in the most recent poll. His favorability among independents is also dropping by 8 points from the previous week, an 8-point drop that would seem to all but wipe out any bounce that he might have received the week before from independent voters following the assassination attempt and the convention. There's also been a lot of attention paid this year to the so-called double haters, those Americans who supposedly have unfavorable views of both Donald Trump and of Joe Biden. Well, there's been movement there as well. In this ABC Ipsos poll, 2 weeks ago, 15% of Americans held unfavorable views of both Trump and Biden, but driven almost entirely, they say, by the increase in Harris's favorability. Well, the proportion of Americans who now dislike both nominees, Donald Trump and now Kamala Harris, well, that has been cut in half to just 7%. So you see where this is all going, at least for now. Very good news for the Democrats. One more measure of enthusiasm among the candidates is which percentage of their supporters say they are absolutely certain to turn out and vote for them. On that score, compared to a poll from early July, there's been an increase in the proportion of Democrats saying they are absolutely certain to vote, going from 70 to 76%. That now is about equal to the 78% of Republicans who say that they are certain to vote in November. And meanwhile, Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance, saw no change in his favorability in the last week, but the proportion of Americans viewing him as unfavorable, well, that has increased. The Ohio senator's favorability rating is now 24%. That's similar to the 23% he had the week prior, but the proportion viewing him unfavorably has skyrocketed by 8 points from 31% the week that he was announced as the GOP vice presidential candidate to an unfavorable rating of 39%. Now that people are getting to know him, and not care for him very much, according to the poll, which is all very unusual for a vice president who has a vice presidential candidate who has just been named on a ticket. Usually their numbers skyrocket. His, however, appear to be plummeting. As to the Veep stakes in this poll, well, in fact, they say that not enough Americans really know the people being talked about. The highest, the best name recognition is for folks like Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, California Governor Gavin Newsom. But a lot of these other folks, Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona, Governor Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania, Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, the pollster said that not enough people knew them to really make much of anything about their favorable, unfavorable numbers. So interesting. Anyway, thought you might want to know. Let's take a quick break here, and we will head back from the horse race back to the track conditions as Republicans begin to unroll their strategy of trying to win this year's elections, not so much at the ballot box, but in the courts. Some of those efforts, which are not going great for them either, by the way, at the moment. Those are straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
The broadcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
We are once again and still, as always, all along the watchtower for you, the Watchtower for Democracy. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Rolling Stone on Monday reports, quote, when election night comes in November, it will be up to thousands of local election officials to certify election results in their counties. Among those election officials are scores of Donald Trump supporters who believe his lies and conspiracies about stolen elections and will be in prime position to act on those beliefs to try to aid his campaign in November. In the swing states of Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania, Rolling Stone and the aptly named American Doom newsletter identified at least 70 pro-Trump election conspiracists currently working as county election officials who have questioned the validity of elections or have delayed or refused to certify results.
How many did you say?
70.
Wow.
In just the swing states. At least 22 of these county election officials, they report, have refused or delayed certification in recent years. So they've actually done it. They've been taking this out for a spin, trying it out, kicking the tires, trying to not certify elections in various cases to see what happens to them. Rolling Stone reports certification of election results is what legal experts consider a ministerial task and one required by state and local law. In other words, they're generally supposed to just sign off on these certifications. But as Trump's lies about the 2020 election have taken hold, Republicans nationwide have decided that certification provides them an opportunity to hear fraud allegations and, more troublingly, to refuse to officially count their local votes. Republicans have refused to certify election results at least 25 times since Trump lost the 2020 election to President Joe Biden. Democratic election lawyer Mark Elias warns, quote, I think we are going to see mass refusals to certify the election in November. Everything we are seeing about this election is that the other side is more organized, more ruthless, and more prepared. But the idea that they are going to there's going to be mass refusals to certify the election. Well, that's one of the things I've been talking about when I said, you know, you have to plan on this going beyond November 5. This ain't going to be over as of Election Day, at least as far as I can tell. Because I do think Elias is right here, at least regarding that refusal to certify these certify results in certain counties in swing states where the Democratic candidate, presumptively Kamala Harris at that point, where she may win in hopes of causing a stalemate, preventing their state totals from being able to be verified, then causing a stalemate in the U.S. House, in which case the presidential election will be decided by a vote in the U.S. House, where each state gets one vote, and where, for the moment anyway, I think Republicans currently have majorities of, I believe, 26 state delegations to the Democrats, 24. Justine Glaw's story at Rolling Stone is a 3,000-word deep dive here, breaking down those concerns in the swing states, in swing state after swing state, and I suspect we will be taking that dive in various weeks in the in various ways in the weeks and the months ahead. For now, though, the legal effort to kick sand into the 2024 election gears, well, that has already begun, even if so far anyway, it is not going particularly well for the Republican vote suppressors. Last week, when Joe Biden announced that he was dropping out and endorsing Vice President Kamala Harris, the Trump campaign immediately filed a complaint at the Federal Election Commission against Kamala Harris for using the Biden-Harris campaign funds for her own campaign. Now, according to UC Irvine election law professor Rick Hassan at his election law blog, most campaign finance lawyers, he says that he knows, believe that she absolutely can use those funds because the Biden-Harris campaign committee was a committee for both Biden and Harris, hence the name. That's the position of the nonpartisan watchdog Campaign Legal Center, for example. Also, FEC Vice Chair Ellen Weintraub has already stated she does not think it's complicated. Harris's name was always on the account, so yeah, she can use it. But Charlie Spies, a Republican election lawyer who, for a time, worked for the Trump campaign, he advanced a different theory in an op-ed over at Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal, arguing that Harris did not have the right to spend the money as the VP. But our friend and longtime campaign finance expert, Brendan Fisher, he points out that Spies' argument would lead to some ridiculous results and would make no sense given how we think of presidential and vice presidential candidates working together using the same campaign committee. Right-wing campaign finance scholar Brad Smith said on Fox Business that the Spies' argument was good, but that the Harris argument is at least plausible. It's at least plausible. Am I right, Brad? Brad Smith. Don't get me started on him. Anyway, he did not think that a judge was going to get involved here. So remember, this is a complaint to the FEC. It is not, at least not yet, a complaint in federal court. And Professor Hassan says he cannot think of a case of real-time enforcement by a judge of federal campaign finance laws. They're traditionally handled by the FEC at least first, and then if there's, you know, if those if someone wants to contest their rulings, then they might file a case in court. Instead, as Brad Smith explained, this will go to the FEC, where it will take at least 60 days for anything at all to happen. And the three Republican and three Democratic appointed FEC commissioners could well deadlock, as they often do. Then there might be a reason to take it to a court. The issue could then eventually get decided in those courts, but it would likely be years later. Hassan notes that we could be looking at the results of the 2028 elections or later before there's actually something definitive on that point. So now Hassan is the expert here, obviously, but he, you know, he may be underestimating how wildly corrupt our courts, both the lower U.S. district courts all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, have now become, as they are littered with corrupt Donald Trump appointees and sympathizers. So we will see. I would not be surprised if they try to get to court as quickly as they can, try to get a Trump-appointed judge, try to get a good finding from them that would normally not come for months or years later. But, you know, they'll come up with some reason. Oh, we need to have a quick decision because we got an election coming up.
Right. And then that way they can still find ways to monkey wrench the election.
And as Hassan notes here, the filing of the complaint alone will now give legal fodder to Trump to say, oh, look, Harris engaged in an even greater campaign finance violation than the one that resulted in Trump's 34 felony convictions in New York for the falsification of business records to hide his pre-election hush money payment to a porn star back in 2016. Oh, what Kamala Harris did is even worse. It's hundreds of millions of dollars. Anyway, Hassan expects we'll hear that argument a lot over the coming days and weeks and months. I think he may be right on that point. It does not take much to imagine Trump on the stump claiming, the Democrats far, far worse than anything that I ever did, anything I was ever accused of, even though what they accused me of was a total scam and there's no crime at all, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, no one said defending democracy was going to be either easy or fun, Des. But for now, I think they'll get little legal traction there.
At least on that one.
Next up here, we've got Republicans trying to charge that it's too late. It's too late to change the candidate on the ballot in a number of states around the country. That was the next argument they tried, but they appear to be very wrong there as well, at least according to CNN, who reported late last week that election authorities of at least 48 states, both Republicans and Democrats, say there are no obstacles that would prevent Vice President Kamala Harris from getting on the election ballots if she becomes the official Democratic presidential nominee, as expected over the next week or two. The findings of a CNN survey of all 50 states undercut the claims of House Speaker Mike Johnson, who said both before and after President Biden dropped out of the race that there are legal impediments in some states to a party switching presidential candidates as the Democrats did. But Mike Johnson, who is actually a lawyer, believe it or not, is just completely wrong on this point, on these legal facts here, much as he was, by the way, when this tool led the legal effort among members of Congress back in 2020 to have the U.S. Supreme Court overturn the 2020 election by tossing out all of the votes in about four different states. So he was wrong then. Mike Johnson is just wrong now. CNN reports there was not a single state election authority that told them that Harris would face a ballot issue as the official nominee. Johnson said on ABC News that, quote, it would be wrong and I think unlawful in accordance to some of these state rules for a handful of people to go in the back room and switch it out because they don't like the candidate any longer. Last Monday on CNN, he said in some of the states, there are impediments to just switching someone out like that. Turns out there are not such impediments, at least not before the nominee has actually been officially determined and certified by the party, by the Democratic Party in this case. Since Democrats have never actually named Biden as their official 2024 nominee or submitted his name to the states as their nominee, election law experts say there's no problem here. Election authorities around the country have now confirmed that to CNN, telling them or saying in public statements that Harris will face no obstacles getting on their ballots if she is formally chosen as the Democratic nominee. The 48 states plus the District of Columbia, whose election authorities have said that the official Democratic nominee will not have ballot issues, include the seven states with the closest margins in 2020, The ones that are widely considered to be the swing states, Georgia, Arizona, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Michigan, Nevada, and so forth. The 48 states also include the 15 states where former President Donald Trump, the 2024 Republican nominee, had his highest share of the vote in 2020. They also say no problem here. Johnson's office did not reply to CNN's request to identify the impediments that he claimed some states have.
Yeah, but he did get his headline, and some voters, that's all they're going to see.
But that, however, still leaves the GOP open to filing actual lawsuits to suppress the vote any way that they can. And I suspect we're going to be covering quite a bit of these in the next several months. Here's one of them that was decided on Sunday. A lawsuit filed earlier this year on behalf of the Republican National Committee, the Mississippi Republican Party, the Mississippi Libertarian Party, and individuals vote and individual voters challenging a Mississippi law that allows mail-in ballots that are postmarked on or before Election Day to be counted if they are received within 5 business days of the election. That was decided by a federal judge on Sunday. The Republicans had argued that the challenged law effectively extends Mississippi's federal election past the election day established by Congress. It results in valid ballots being diluted by untimely invalid ballots. Remember, these are ballots that were voted and mailed and postmarked on time by election day. They just didn't arrive by election day. They arrived about 5 days later. Well,
so Republicans want to get it tossed on a technicality.
The good news here, well, it's not a technicality. It violates the right to vote under the 14th Amendment, and it violates the First Amendment, violates all sorts of things. Well, good news, on Sunday, the court granted the defendant's motion for summary judgment. In other words, the judge found the suit lacked merit, and the court found against the plaintiffs, tossed the entire matter even before a trial. Mail-in ballots that are postmarked on or before Election Day will be counted in the state of Mississippi if they are received within 5 business days of the election, pending, naturally, any different rulings from higher, more corrupt courts. Republicans have filed similar lawsuits already in Illinois, Nevada, North Dakota, and elsewhere. Most of them have failed as well, but expect them to keep trying to disenfranchise voters in whatever way they can between now and November 5 and unfortunately beyond, as their plan is clearly to wreak havoc should they lose again in hopes of throwing the election into question and into the U.S. House, where they hope to hold a majority of congressional contingents, which would then decide one vote per state who will become the next president of the United States. That is very much the GOP plan for this November. And if they're unable to win the normal way by simply winning enough votes to win enough states outright and having, certifying those votes without creating fake questions about the results to win the 270 electoral votes needed to win in order to secure the presidency, well, this is plans, B, C, and D. That is very much what guys like Kevin Roberts, the president of the Republican Heritage Foundation with their Project 2025, that's what he means when he recently said this.
We are winning. There are a lot of victories that have been secured. Some of them are partial. Some of them in ways that the other side doesn't yet know are foundations for what's coming. And that's just the beginning. And we're not going to tell you everything that's coming, because for the first time that I'm aware of, the conservative movement, or as I really like to put it, the common sense movement in the United States has really nothing to do with ideology, is ready to fight.
So, things we don't even know about, that they're already winning. Well, that could refer to the plans to not certify results in various swing states in various ways. Plans to throw it to the U.S. House however they can so they can steal the election there. So we will see, and we will be watching those things very closely over the next few months. By the way, it was announced on Monday that Paul Danz, the head of the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025, was becoming just too much of an annoyance, I guess, to the Trump campaign, to Donald Trump specifically. Too many people were talking about Project 2025. He doesn't want him. He'll do it. He just doesn't want him to talk about it. So apparently Danz is now stepping down. There's reports that they're ending the Project 2025. They ain't ending anything. I don't have enough time to go into details right now, but do not buy it. This is a 50-year project to dismantle the federal government, to put the president personally in charge of everything that is left, and with it, repeal the entire 20th century. Project 2025 is not going anywhere. They may be trying to hide it, but it's not going away. Don't be fooled. Desi Doyen and the Green News Report is next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. Okay, no chattery. Let's get right to it. Our latest Green News Report.
Obviously, with the temperatures and the winds, everything's just kind of aligned perfectly for this fire to be burning 4,000 to 5,000 acres an hour.
Northern California wildfire explodes in size. Paris Summer Olympics complicated by heat and water pollution. Plus,
it's summertime, but the living is no longer easy.
After new global heat records, the UN calls on governments to move faster to cut climate warming emissions.
All of those calls and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Well, let me say at the outset, Kamala can't have my guns, she can't have my gasoline engine, and she sure as hell can't have my steaks and cheeseburgers.
Well, let me say at the outset, Ted Cruz, Kamala doesn't want your guns, or your gasoline engine, or your steaks and cheeseburgers. Though you might lay off a few of those cheeseburgers, Ted Cruz. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen. It's not that Ted Cruz is fat. I'm just saying that, you know,
you're concerned about his health.
Exactly right. What do you have for us today?
Well, first, in the U.S. West, record-breaking heat waves have rapidly dried out forests. Northern California's massive wind-driven park fire has grown into the sixth largest fire in state history in just 1 week, forcing the evacuations of nearly 25,000 people and the closure of Lassen Volcanic National Park.
This fire is horrific.
It is the largest fire in the U.S., for now, and has burned more than 560 square miles, an area larger than Los Angeles. A man was charged with arson in igniting the fire, but experts say its ferocious growth has been supercharged by land management policies that enabled extreme fires and human-caused climate change, which has increased the intensity and duration of extreme heat waves and the number of days with extreme wildfire weather conditions. So far, California's wildfire season has burned about 20 times more land than this time last year. According to CAL FIRE, the biggest fires in state history have all hit in the last 6 years.
And of course, it doesn't help that we've had record heat in many of those years.
Yep. In Canada, where crews are battling hundreds of wildfires.
Ted Cruz?
No. Fire crews are battling hundreds of wildfires. A fast-moving fire destroyed about a third of the village of Jasper outside Jasper National Park. In Houston, an updated confirmed death toll from Hurricane Beryl, which came ashore as a Category 1 on July 8th. Forensic examiners across the Houston region now say 36 people were killed. Disturbingly, at least half of them died after the storm in homes without air conditioning during the week's long power outage amid a sweltering, humid heat wave. In Paris, where the Summer Olympics are now underway, France's National Weather Service issued an extreme heat warning this week, with temperatures approaching 100 degrees Fahrenheit, high humidity, and elevated nighttime temperatures. Because the athletes' lodgings do not have air conditioning,
really?
The U.S., Canada, and several other countries have brought portable AC units for their athletes that will then be donated to local groups. Plus, runoff from heavy rains has degraded water quality in the River Seine, forcing organizers to postpone the men's triathlon event because the water is unsafe for swimming.
Postpone or cancel?
We'll see. Here in the U.S., as student athletes begin outdoor practice for the fall, a new analysis warns parents and coaches that today's kids are playing in a much warmer world than in the past. Climate Central found that most locations in the United States are seeing at least one additional week of extremely hot days than in the early 1970s. They say extreme heat is risky for athletes of all ages, and preparing for extreme heat and educating students about it is key to protecting their health and safety. Finally, in remarks at the United Nations on Friday, just days after the planet set a new record for the three hottest days ever recorded globally, Secretary General Antonio Guterres again pushed world leaders to pick up the pace in shifting away from climate-warming fossil fuels. A new UN study last week found 70% of the global workforce is at high risk of extreme heat, and it estimated that extreme heat kills about 500,000 people every year globally. The Secretary General criticized wealthy developed countries like the United States for continuing fossil fuel production that causes man-made climate change, and he called on world leaders to do more to protect lives amid rising temperatures.
And we know it's going to get worse. Extreme heat is the new abnormal. But the good news is that there are solutions, and we can limit its impact.
I hope he's right. He's been trying to get us to do exactly that for years, and we're just not making fast enough progress, if you ask me.
We are not.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.brandblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
The message is clear. The heat is on.
And this has been your Green News Report. Yes, it certainly is.
Yes.
By the way, that park fire when we recorded the GNR earlier today was the sixth largest fire in state history.
And now it's the fifth.
Not going well. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. And thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. Hey, while you're there, please hit one of those donate buttons if you don't mind, or you can go straight to bradblog.com/donate, and you, yes, you can help us stay on your public airwaves, at least through this election and beyond. bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site forever known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Till we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.